Welcome to Meet the Writers. Now, this week, with so much going on in the book world, we can't fit it all into one programme. So, on The Big Interview, you can find my conversation with the Man Booker winner, the American debut novelist George Saunders. And my guest here today is a British author who's also a theatre and television actor. Her 2011 debut novel, When God Was a Rabbit, became an international bestseller and won several awards. Her next two books, A Year of Marvellous Ways and Tin Man, have been equally well received. And I'm thrilled she's in the studio with me today. Sarah Winman, thank you for coming in.
My pleasure.
We have been trying to do this forever.
Years, actually.
Since your first book.
Yes, completely. Well, that's a long time now.
But that's great for me because actually it means that every book I've read with a view to talking to you about it. And I feel like, although we've had these conversations at various festivals around the country, I feel like... Yeah. Yeah, that your work is something that I've really, really seen progress and move on, and each book builds on the last.
Oh, that's amazing. Thank you.
And The Tin Man is marvellous. As I say, we've been planning this for ages, but it's rather like you're writing because it seems like you were always a storyteller, but you just weren't quite sure what method you would use to get that story out.
Well, I think that's really exact, and I think it's quite true, actually. That's what I class myself as. I think I'm a storyteller. Novelist seems a little bit too grand for somebody who's never studied it. But that is the medium that I'm telling stories now. So I always think actors are storytellers. That's what we do. And so that is what I've done. And so I think often people go, well, you know, that transition from acting to writing, when did you think about doing it? And I don't think I ever did think about doing it. I always thought it was a natural progression that came out of necessity. It came out of I had so much time on my hands because I wasn't working. And there was a great need to reinstate self-expression and creativity again after not working so much. So it's just a desire to tell stories, as you say.
Have you always told stories? You grew up in Essex. Was that a very literary environment?
No, one would not actually call it a very literary environment.
Your family home may have been.
My family were wonderful storytellers. My mother always read. She was a great one for trying to basically foist books onto me. My brother read a lot. I didn't as a child. I found reading boring. I only say this to give hope to people out there who are saying, my child doesn't read. You know, what are they going to turn into? Don't worry yet.
When does it kick in?
When did it kick in? Well, I did read occasionally. So I have my three books, as I've always said, which were Stig of the Dump, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and Flat Stanley. And those three books were immense and caught my imagination. But I wanted to be outside. I wanted to ride my bike, different world. I wanted to just escape and have adventures. I loved television. It was a very different television to it.
I was going to say, television was crap then, wasn't it?
Well, you know, there was this series, an Australian series called The Great Barrier Reef, and I still remember it today. And it's very hard for me to find any information about it. So I sometimes wonder if I imagined it. So I loved that. So there was the sea that was always beckoning. And I also loved David Carradine in Kung Fu. And I collected all the bubblegum cards for that. So what I mean by all this was that there was an active engagement with what I was seeing, what I was listening to, what I was occasionally reading, with my own imagination. And that's the point that is necessary.
Yeah.
School did not really enhance a reading list for me in any way. And it was something that I kind of came to probably in my late 20s for joy. I was always reading, obviously, nonfiction, but actually thinking that fiction for joy had a place, I was probably late coming to it.
So what led you to Webber Douglas, to drama school?
A strange moment in assembly at my high school that I had been, you know, children are creative. It depends whether they want to carry on with that. And I think I sort of did. I was always doing little bits and pieces in my primary school. And then I ended up in a grammar school. That was my secondary school. It wasn't my favourite place. Nothing happened. Nothing bad happened. But because it was the period of time when Margaret Thatcher was getting rid of so many, this was hanging on by its fingertips. And therefore, the emphasis was on exam results. And suddenly, there was no room for creativity or the arts for me. And I just felt a series of doors shutting down. And the main clunk came, I think, when a teacher asked me, I probably would have been about 15, what I was hoping to do with my life. What would I like to do? And I sat there and said, I'd like to be a ski instructor. And I could ski at that time. And I could just see that this possibility and this life would actually suit me. And she said, well, you won't be doing that. Yeah. And I think I was talking about this recently, that I think I found some old school reports, and a lot of them used to say that I was tired. And I don't. I think that was a shutting down.
Yeah.
You know, I think that happens when you are not being nurtured in things that maybe interest you. I'm getting to your question in a minute. I really am. I haven't forgotten it. So there am I sitting there. And these last two or three years were, you know, a tired person who was quite uninterested, carrying on with what my parents hoped for me and my teachers did, but not really what I wanted.
Which was an academic career.
Yeah. Well, I mean, whether I don't think I would have been an academic. I don't think I'm. That's the way my brain works. Mm. But certainly university, mm. and it was set up at that school. So, in assemblies at the end of the year, from what I remember, people used to stand up. The people who were leaving, the girls who were leaving, the young women who were leaving, would stand up and say what they were going to do. And it was basically university, university, university. We had a lot of nurses because that really was, you know, there was a different structure then. So that was a very viable career. We had that. Then out of the blue, this woman stood up and she goes, I'm going to Bristol Old Vic Theatre School. And I remember sitting there and thinking, so am I. And I hadn't done a play at school. We weren't doing any. I think we did after that. And I, you know, the variance of memory, I really don't think we had, because eventually it took me three attempts to get to drama school, which is not somebody who's well practiced. But it is one of those moments where your instinct and the resonance of desire is so strong and you hear it, mm-hmm. you know, whatever you want to call that particular moment, everyone has a different word for it. But I have trusted that voice ever since. And that was it. I didn't go to Bristol. You know, I went to Webber Douglas, but it was that desire. It was like, okay, somebody's opened a door. That is now possible.
And was it marvellous? Did you feel all that creativity coming back?
I did. But, you know, it took a while because there was a definite separation between head and body, actually, by the time I went there. And it took a while for them to merge. So that but I think part of why that was really good for me, I suppose emotionally and psychologically, if you want to sort of go on that journey, was that I needed a bridge. I needed to know how to link my words, my communication, my heart, my feelings, all of that. And there's nothing better than to be given these great words that that playwrights had written. Mm. And you have to interpret it. You are the instrument. And you have to bring resonance to these words and you have to make sense. So I found my words. I found part of myself through other people's words. And I suppose that was the start of the journey, really.
Mm. Tell me about your roles, because you did some really exciting things.
I don't know. What have you got down there?
Let me see. What does it say? As an actress, she was known in the 90s and 2000s as Chief Superintendent Louise Campbell in The Bill. And she's appeared in Holby City and Casualty.
The Bill would have been very exciting because it was going to be semi-regular. And I'd already planned what I was going to do because I thought, semi-regular means, you know, semi-regular money. And I hadn't, you know, that's the actor's. That was certainly my actor's life. Not much to show for it. So there I was thinking, great. And I would get these scripts and I'd have quite a lot to do, you know, and there would be these different cases and I would be interviewing, talking mainly to the other policemen. I don't know what happened. I don't know if they had second thoughts about casting. But when you get onto sort of The Bill and Holby, pages, new pages come through all the time. I don't know if it's pink pages or green pages, but they're rushed through on the morning of filming. Every time I was on set, they'd go, oh, new pages for you. And I can swear that mainly they were, right, I don't think we'll be pursuing this case anymore. And that was it. So after thinking that I had something interesting, it was nothing. There wasn't. They were just shut it down. So this, what could have been this incredibly memorable character, because I'd fleshed her out, just became a piece of dust in television history.
Yeah. But you've done theatre and you've done film too.
I did a little bit of film. I mean, that's what everybody wants to do, and that's the hard thing. Yeah. I mean, film's sexy. There is something about it. There is something about even the, you know, way back then, the kind of cameras that we used and the sound and the changing of film cartridges, the whole thing. And people who work on film are very whoever they are, they're kind of sexy because that's the environment. And we have film crew actually just down by us in the City of London at the moment. And I still get a thrill when I pass it because I know they're creating something really magical. And I know that they will be in situ for 3 days for, I don't know, 30 seconds of screen time.
It's very little, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. But they're so dedicated.
Yeah.
So no, I loved film, but I really didn't do a huge amount of it.
What film did you do, in fact?
I did. The first one I ever did was a film called Staggered with Martin Clunes. I think he had written it, but he was directing and acting it, and it was one of the first ones whereby actors pretty much did it for free. And that was a period where, I can't remember what it was called now, it had a particular title. It's not delayed payment. Deferred payment. Deferred payment means that you never see it. There is no deferment. But it was a great way of sort of honing a muscle and doing it and being with a lot of people who wanted to be there, which is always great in collaboration. So we did that. And, you know, it was rough around the edges, but it kind of disappeared because it came out at a similar time as a film called 4 Weddings and a Funeral, which is how it all works. You get bumped, and that's the same way. Books can get bumped as well. Mm. They can be overshadowed by something else. But it was really, really good fun and good people.
And you were exploring your own words, as you say, during that time. Your father fell ill.
My father was ill. He was diagnosed in 2001, a long, long time. So with blood cancer that remained quite stable for years. In fact, it didn't even erupt in his lifetime of that period. But what happened was halfway through, he was then second diagnosis of advanced prostate. So that probably was about 2005. And then he died 5 years later. But it coincided with what was happening in hospitals, the superbugs that were going around. So he got C. diff at one point, but came through that. I mean, he's an extremely strong man. I mean, he took ages, really, to die in a way because his heart was so strong. You know, he'd been an athlete and had always been fit. But it's astonishing because had he not fallen ill, I'm not sure I would have written. I think there's a big question mark around that. So I think it was quite a potent time. I was in my 40s, I hadn't been working. You start to see the decline of people you love and how that sort of how that resonates around family. And you need to find some kind of meaning in it. And I think the arts are great for that.
Mm. And of course, When God Was a Rabbit is full of family ties. I mean, all of that experience plays into it in some way, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot set in the area where I live. There was St. Bart's Hospital that I got to know extremely well, and all the people who work there who still today, I mean, they're incredible. It's an incredible hospital. So what you do is you take the fact, you take of what you have experienced, and you change the ending. Or you change the middle, and you change the characters. You hold them together with this kind of weave of what you experienced, which is generally love and sort of an acceptance and all of that. But you create different things from that in order to tell that story. But yeah, I suppose in two words, how I would describe Rabbit would be starting again. And I think that was kind of potent because we couldn't change things. You know, it's a very familiar story in all families with loss. You know, there is a point where you know this is going to play out no matter what, no matter how much willing you do and no matter how much you turn up for people, there is a story here and there is an ending and they're heading towards that. So it was quite interesting to be able to explore that and bring around the dark humour that obviously occupies that space as well.
And I mean, the story goes over sort of decades.
It goes over, what is it, 1968 to 2001, I think it is.
But it's wonderful in the way that the voices change and everything, and really very technical for somebody who wasn't a trained writer, that anybody can particularly be trained. So how difficult was it sort of finding a voice, first of all, but really finding that very technical way into something that's really very complex?
I don't know. I just rework. I redraft and I rework until it's a book that I would like to read. The one thing I do have is I'm very good at self-editing. I can flag up that kind of perfectionism that is very negative. So I don't actually think that's something to aim for at all, really. But, you know, I'm good at that kind of selection. Actors are good at it as well. We are absorbing structure in a way that we don't realise it. And I was thinking about this the other day, that it allowed me to also write out of sequence, even though it's a linear book. Because certainly when you're working on telly or you're working on film, you film out of sequence. Mm. So when you go to these scenes, you have to hold your story and know exactly where you are emotionally. And I realise that that's something that I do with writing, that if I can't get into the story the way I want to, then I will have in my mind 3, 4, 5 emotional scenes that they will anchor me. So I will write those scenes. So I realise that helps. With Rabbit, going back to that, it was easy to start it at the beginning. That was it. Start it from birth. And that's quite fun to do. It's quite fun to inhabit childhood in that way because you can get away with so much. But unsentimentally, I think that's a really big key that you have to watch out for.
Mm.
I don't like sentiment in that way. I don't like writing to music. It'll have to be, you know, again, actors do not act to music. The music is put on afterwards in order to manipulate the audience. So, again, I write in silence and just allow. If the emotion's not coming through the words, then the words aren't right. So I believe that. So if you put all those things into the mix, it sort of works. And also, it's a book of two parts, I think, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
I haven't read it for a long time.
Yeah.
So it was going to be childhood and then adulthood, so consequences of that. And I wasn't going to do the messy bit of teenage years, you know, that can come in another book or something. So for me, it didn't feel that hard because there was still that linear direction. And because you're dealing with younger people, there is great forward momentum. Whereas the books, well, the second book was an older woman, and that proved tricky, you know, because they didn't really have the forward momentum. You know, she was constantly looking back. So
that's A Year of Marvellous Ways,
yeah.
Which Marvellous is such a fantastic character, and just a beautiful woman, really, in every way. And it's a very spiritual book, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Well, you know, Rabbit was written the 2 years, I suppose, leading up to my father's death, and Marvellous was 3 years after his death. And so there was a different resonance around. There was a different sense of interior monologue and seeing my mother cope with grief, seeing other people cope with grief, because I started to see other older women losing companions in that way. And there is something very beautiful about older women and that journey. I suppose it is sort of what I would call, not that I'm a great scholar of this in any way, but the Jungian notion of the great feminine. And that's really what she was.
And a healer.
And a healer.
And the sea as the backdrop and all of that coming together as this great kind of spiritual presence.
Exactly. Yeah. Just living in these woods on the edge, because women can't be like that. So they were always shoved to the edge of society generally. She is the wise woman, but without that sort of Cornish witchiness, which I didn't really want.
Mm.
I wanted her to be absolutely at the pulse of nature, that she lived with instinct, by her instinct, with resonance, with receptivity, with cherishing the earth was a big one.
Mm.
But the whole notion of cherishing matter, and matter meaning mother, and all of that coming into the earth and cherishing her body. And it was very necessary that she had this sensuality with her body as well.
Mm.
All the things, basically, that are not honoured and given respect today.
Mm. But very big themes in the novel, actually, just of, sustaining.
Sustaining, feeding, not being frightened of food, not being frightened of those things.
Both of those first two books, real sweeping landscape, Cornwall, but very cinematic.
Mm.
And I imagine influenced very much by your past work.
Yeah, I think I write envisaging that. You know, it's a big screen when I sit down to write. And I learn a lot from cinema. I learn a lot from camera movements, actually. It's a good way of solving problems. Often I will look at other people's books. One in particular, when I was reading Olive Kittredge, I really, really did envisage a moving camera as to picking up different POV. And I think that's quite
interesting.
Useful.
Yeah.
So I do that. And I do. I envisage this sort of establishing shot of landscape and then honing in on who might be there and that sort of flying camera covering this vast area and actually a life that's lived in a tiny, tiny caravan. Mm. Yeah, I mean, I do. I get a lot of answers from cinema. And still, it's probably still my first love, actually. Yeah.
Well, in fact, your latest book takes its title from a very great movie,
doesn't it?
So The Tin Man, why call it The Tin Man?
It was always going to be called Tin Man because it is a job at a car factory. And I heard about this job years ago, probably somewhere about late 90s. And they're known as the Tinny. They are highly specialised, basically panel beater. And in the days of manufacturing, rather than assembly, they would be at different points along the line. And so maybe at the beginning, if there was a panel that had just been pressed and it was, you know, going to be soldered and put together with something else, if there was a dent or a minor blemish, they would take it to the tinny bay, see Tin Man, and he would have this array of handmade tools and would just get it out. And I think there is still one around today, but that's right in the at the end of the paint shop, which is even more incredible because these cars are pretty much done. They're painted and they're polished and they're just beautiful. And if there is one there, a little mark, these guys can get it out without damaging the paint, which I still don't really understand how it's done. I've sat down with a man who did 30 years at the Cowley car plant, and it was very interesting to talk to him about it because he found it hard to describe what he did because he'd always done it. And so we had to sit down and I had to really, really look at his hands and say, just pretend, what are you doing here? And we'd draw a lot of diagrams. And I kind of have an idea of it, but it's still something that's, I thought was very beautiful. I think that's why it caught my imagination, that in this very, what would have been predominantly working class area, that it's quite an artistic form. You know, it's like sculpture. It's so, who could do it? Who would do it? There's a story there. And I think that's why I'd always stayed with it. It was quite romantic. And I remember saying this to the guy who did it, and he just looked at me as if I was completely barking. Like, why would I romanticise this job? But I did.
But there is so much beauty in ordinariness, really. I mean, it starts with this amazing act of defiance where this woman chooses a painting, a reproduction of Van Gogh's Sunflowers. And for her, it's the most beautiful thing she's ever seen. And it's this utter inspiration for her life. I wonder if that particular painting speaks to you.
No, it didn't. It didn't at all. I came to it via his writing. I don't know if you know his writing. He was a prolific letter writer. And Irving Stone collected these letters to Van Gogh's brother Theo and into a collection of it almost reads like short stories. It's not, but a collection called Dear Theo. And I was familiar with Arles because of the photographic festival down there. I'd been down there many times, so I was very aware of Van Gogh's presence down there. And there are sunflowers everywhere. They're on socks, they're on umbrellas. And sometimes you become repelled by how popular something is because almost the meaning goes when you see it so much. So I had no interest, actually, in it. I preferred the irises or Starry Night of the Rhone or, you know, and obviously, when you're there, you see Café Terrace at night. It's very obvious. It's massive commercialism, but you still see it. So, no. And then I started reading this book. And it is the most incredible book of the mind of an artist. I would highly recommend it if anybody just wanted to know about this man. I think it's almost like the definitive. And he's so clear about love and art and what he wants to achieve. And I'm more familiar with the last part. It's only about that thick, what am I saying? Half an inch, really, about his journey to the South. And that's all he wanted to do. He wanted to journey. He knew that he would be a better artist if he followed the light and followed the sun. And he wanted to set up an artist studio down there, and he was waiting for Paul Gauguin to join him. And he was so excited about this. I mean, it almost reads as a love affair, in a way. And in his lead up to Gauguin arriving, I mean, it all went horrendously pear-shaped. We know the story. But in the lead up, he would write very clearly about the colours he was using for the paintings. And he was writing to his brother about the set of sunflowers paintings that he was doing because he wanted them as decoration for Gauguin's room. And I thought that was a lovely thing. It was almost as if he was going out to pick these flowers. And he was talking about the various different colours of the earthenware vase and the ochres and the yellows. And everything was yellow, 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 you know.
As is your book, yeah.
Yes, this is how he talked. He said, how wonderful that there are so many versions of yellow down here. So he was absolutely transfixed by it. So this idea of these flowers being painted possibly for someone was the reason I liked this painting. And of course, I had already named the book, called the book Tin Man, and I knew, obviously, the association with the film. Instead of running away from it, how could I include it? Is there anything that I enjoyed in the film that could be sort of the motif? And it was about journeying. It was about the yellow brick road, about coming to the end of something and having this moment of sort of self-actualization.
A woman who believes that men and boys are capable of beautiful things. I mean, that's really at the heart of it.
It is. Yeah. Painting flowers for a man who's coming to stay.
Yeah.
Having a husband who's 3 years returned from war and who's clearly violent. That war did this. A very industrial landscape that she didn't expect to find herself in. So all of these things, she's still holding on to that pulse.
I don't want to spoil the book for people. I feel that they need to discover it for themselves. It's huge, though. It has huge themes. The AIDS epidemic, there are a lot of gay characters, or some gay characters, indeed, in lots of your work, but they're not gay books. It's so, so interesting. I mean, I would urge people to not only read this book, but to look back at your previous work, because it all just does work so beautifully together.
I hope so.
Finally, just that intensity of youthful friendship, I think, is so interesting in this book.
I think so. I don't think we give time to it. I think men don't give time to it.
Yeah.
I mean, the one thing that I can say without giving it away is, you know, it is a story about three people. It's about Ellis and Annie and Michael. It's about the marriage between Ellis and Annie. And you're absolutely right. It's about the best friendship of them all, but it's about a love affair, actually, between Michael and Ellis when they were young men, before Annie. What has been very interesting for me is that a lot of men have talked to me about these best friendships that they had when, you know, they were 13 or 14. And they were. It involved love. It couldn't be talked about, of course not. And we're not talking about a relationship. And we're certainly not talking about every man who's had feelings for another man is gay. Absolutely not. It's about the vulnerability of just being excited about seeing your mate the next day and what that actually means.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers. Sarah Winman's new novel, Tin Man, is published by Headline Publishing. Thanks to George McDonough and researchers Daphne Karnitsis and Amalia Ilgner. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. And do head over to The Big Interview to hear my conversation with the Man Booker winner, George Saunders. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.